Okay, so the purpose of this discussion, here I'm representing a different collaboration, attempting to develop a new tool, a different perspective on the electron-boson interaction of the cuprates. And it's, at least in conception, it's to be built on the traditional inelastic tunneling scheme, which was a key piece of the identification of the mechanism of conventional superconductivity by McMillan and Rohr. We want to use inelastic tunneling spectroscopic imaging to get at electron-boson interactions. In case I forget to say it, at this stage, there's no implication in the talk that if I find an electron-boson interaction, it is necessarily the boson supporting the superconductivity. That remains to be discussed at a later stage.
But then the original argument that they confirmed the electron phonon also shouldn't have been.
Well, that's an excellent point. They didn't use just one piece of information. They used a combination of the isotope effect plus neutron scattering to know what mode they were dealing with. Then they measured alpha squared F of omega, which for those unfamiliar with superconductivity, this is the coupling constant of the electrons to the bosons, and this is the density of boson states. They measured this number. They showed that this function came from a mode which was independently identified as being a phonon. And then they had the McMillan equation, which allows you, if you know something about the Coulomb term, to plug this information in here and show that TC is completely explained by the electron-boson interaction strength, right, which is detected. So in this talk, perhaps I'll be shedding some light on this piece of information for the cuprates. Yes, sir.
Another aspect is in the conventional materials, there's no disagreement about whether there's a Fermi liquid or not, which is what the theory is
exactly
built on.
So that's the way you can answer the third corner.
Correct. But to comment on that, John, the detailed theory of what one should observe is based on the requirement that there's a von der Lubov D-wave superconductor.
No.
And there's...
No.
Yes, it
no,
is.
No.
No, sorry, let me finish my sentence.
The ECS theory, you're built on a normal state Fermi liquid theory.
So what goes into the calculations that we're working with is the idea that the superconducting state in the cuprates is a D-wave VCS superconductor and can be represented by the conventional gap equation with von der Lubov excitations. That could exist even if the normal state were not a Fermi liquid.
Sure, but Ely-Ashberg theory, which connects the excitations that you're measuring, is built on Fermi liquid theory. And
to TC? I completely agree. That's correct.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think if you go back and look at it, what happens is if you take the Ely-Ashberg theory, what you need there is some control of the vertex direction. If you have the control of the vertex direction, then the Ely-Ashberg equations work with Dress-Green's functions, Dress interaction. And if, for example, you go in and find that the breadth, as you do in lead, and quasi-particles operating in the main region where the pairing is occurring, if that breadth of your quasi-particles up at that energy region happen to be broader than the energy they had, so that you might naively say there's no quasi-particle. You'll find that's exactly the case. So that I believe the situation is that there's no reason that you can't have a theory of what we're talking about here if you could calculate what we call the single particle Green's functions and the pairing vertex, if you could do that. Our problem in this case is we don't have a small parameter. And therefore, we're at the mercy of either good guesses or numerical calculations. But I think the framework can be very much, is identical diagrammatically. And that means you're going to go to all orders, but you may not call it quasi-particles when you look at what the G does. But the structure can indeed be very similar, and that's what we're finding out from Monte Carlo. You can do it, it's just from, we don't know how to do it for advention plate.
Okay.
Can I quickly make a quick comment here? What helped in the usual Macmillan rule is that phonons basically didn't care about superconductivity. So you do it at some temperature below TC and you get the same result. Here it's presumably not the case. Whatever boson you get will be affected by the by what happens.
Let's wait and see here.
Okay.
Let's wait and see. But in answer to that, you can stay at low temperatures. And you can come around the circuit, but not ask if you get TC, but ask if you get the gap at zero temperature.
Yes.
And that completes the same circuit.
Yeah.
No, and I find that it's satisfying.
Yeah.
But it avoids what you just said.
Yeah. And we would hope to travel on that route precisely. So this work is, the leaders here are, it's done in measurements done in my lab in Cornell. Key collaborators are Isake and Uchida Sensei, and very important collaborators at the end of the talk are from Sasha Beletsky's group, Jan Zinzu, and I should say that Jinho Lee, who's a postdoc in my group, is the one who did these amazing experiments. So, we've just had a little discussion of electron-phonon interactions in conventional superconductivity, and I'll make a few comments about interactions in cuprate high TC. Then some motivation, then discuss experiments. Then I have to discuss scattering. There's no signal for the STM unless there's scattering. And then finally we'll get to the Fourier transform inelastic tool and the conclusions. So here's the basic idea. You have some delocalized electronic states, and then you have an STM tip which could tunnel to the surface. It has a certain density of electronic states, that's DIDD. Suppose there's a bosonic mode there. Suppose it was just the vibrational mode of a molecule. It's coupled to the electrons in the surface. You could tunnel directly to the Fermi liquid, or you can excite the modes in this bosonic object. And when you work out the details, there's a step in the density of states, or a peak in D2IdV squared. The strength of this peak is quadratic in the electron mode coupling. It goes as G squared, and it's linear in the original density of states that you had before you had the electron boson coupling. Now, this is very well known for the case, let's say, of finding vibrational modes in molecules from many decades ago. This is like 40 years ago. Planar tunneling with molecules inside, you could find the various modes by measuring D2IdV squared as a function of V. When the electron excites the mode, then it changes the density of states, and D2IdV squared is the derivative. So a couple of years ago, about 4 years ago now, Wilson Ho, who was then at Cornell, succeeded in doing this for a single molecule. You take the STM tip, you put it on top of a single molecule, and you can find that there's a little peak in D2IdV squared at the correct energy, which had been determined by optical techniques for the modes. And he even did the isotope experiment. He changed the isotopes in the molecules, and he proved that these little peaks at a single molecule are the electron boson coupling at that location. And this was a big motivation for us. So here's the conventional way of getting this information. In a planar junction, DIDV as a function of V was measured. There are steps in DIDV, which is the same as little broad peaks in D2IdV squared. And you can use this information. You need some normal state information as well, but you can get this electron phonon coupling constant, and then via the process we've been discussing, confirm the mechanism of conventional superconductivity. This was a tour de force, a brilliant achievement in 20th century condensed matter physics to find that this was the mechanism. Okay, so here's DIDV from an STM tip in the cuprates. It's been known for a very long time that there not only are there these sharp peaks, but there are these objects here. Now, these things have been ascribed to a lot of different phenomena. And I'm somewhere in the middle of my talk, I want to make an empirical argument that they indeed should be associated with bosons, but we need to go along to get to that point. These sloping lines here are shallow peaks in D2IdV squared in the derivative of this function. That much is manifest. if there were electron boson coupling effects, well, they could be coupling to phonons, or the famous antiferromagnetic collective spin resonance, or various spin density and charge density wave fluctuations, polarons, spin pyrals, modes, various local modes, the apical mode at the dopant site, or there have many others have been discussed. Now, there is a history of doing this, of course. There's a famous series of experiments by Jasinski where he took a piece of BISCO and broke it in half, and then brought the ends back close to each other and measured the tunnel current. And he did that for a sequence of dopings. Now, the properties of this junction were unknown. You know, it was a break junction, but it had a clear tunnel current. And you could measure the, now in some of these papers, this is referred to, you know, as the density of states as a function of energy, but it's not, because it's SIS tunneling. You're tunneling from two D-wave superconductors, between two D-wave superconductors. So what this is the differential conductance of some kind of a Josephson junction as a function of the bias voltage. And then they focused on these dips here as being somehow relevant to the boson. We have to respectfully disagree with that. We don't think that that deduction is correct. And primarily because this is not the density of states. It's the conductance for an unknown Josephson junction. But even if that were not the case, this type of experiment doesn't have any local information. It doesn't really have any momentum space information. Here's the Wilson-Ho experiment where you can locally detect what the electron boson properties are. And here is the situation we're facing, at least in BISCO, where we have electronically inhomogeneous environment, and possibly there is something which is triggering it. One could wish that one knew where the boson modes were in this field of view. That would be very interesting. The ones coupling to the electronic structure. Now, you can take a D-wave model. Later in the talk, I have a list of groups who have done this. It's in relatively weak coupling. If you take a D-wave BCS model and you couple it to a bosonic mode, you can show easily that you get the expected signature. Here's the differential conductance, and here's the derivative of the differential conductance. There's a little step here, or a peak in the derivative, at the maximum of the gap plus the mode energy, omega plus delta. That's a characteristic of what I call the Eliasberg situation, where there's a peak in the inelastic signal at a gap energy plus delta. It occurs at that location because it's the maximum intensity of the signal of an original spectrum which had a large peak at delta. That's why it appears at that point.
Are you talking about some phenomenological model right now, right here?
No, this is D-wave BCS.
Yeah, so my question...
Oh, what's the boson? This was just the...
My question is the boson part of the electronic system, or is it some external?
External. Okay, let's talk about some experiments. So here's our surface we have to work with. On this surface, we measure the differential conductance as a function of bias, as a function of location with atomic resolution. So what about the next derivative? Experimentalists in the audience know that measuring the next derivative is very much harder than measuring the previous derivative. Extremely difficult. For example, the Barry Stipe and Wilson-Ho experiment, this spectrum here, which was not their best, but a legitimate spectrum, it took 10 hours to get that inelastic signal at one location. And this was, for a long time, the world-leading achievement in that field. So at 10 hours, if you took 256 squared pixels, that's 100 years. So it is essentially defined to be impossible to map the inelastic structure. But it's not. Here was the conventional data sets that we were dealing with until recently, and they certainly, in the derivative out here, they're basically noise. They don't contain any information. But using this ultra-low vibration facility at Cornell, this underground double Russian doll ultra-low vibration Krasnet lab, with this ultra-low vibration condition of the head. And indeed, if you talk to Wilson-Ho, he understands very clearly that the main thing he was fighting were femtometer scale vibrations. That was the limitation of the experiment.
So now, our spectra, if we set up to do the 2IdV squared, the DIdV spectra looked like this. But more importantly, the second derivative is now smooth, and we can see where the peaks are. For each tunnel spectrum, we can know where the peak associated with this shallow slope is, and so find its energy. Here's a more detailed picture. So here's a typical DIdV spectrum. If you take the derivative, there's a maximum in the 2IdV squared or minimum in the 2IdV squared here. And if you subtract the peak height from the value at which that occurs, that's what this scale is, it occurs somewhere here. This is just about 50 millimeters. And then, as these spectra are different in different locations and different dopings, we can see the value of that peak moving around. So at the moment, the proposal is that the energy scale at which this object occurs minus the gap at that location tells us what the main electron, what the energy of the boson is, which is interacting with the electrons. So one can map this. So here's a topographic image. Here's a gap map, so we know delta at every location. And now here's an omega map. It's a map of the energy at which the d2idv squared peak occurs minus delta at every location. And it's centered somewhere near 52 millivolts. It's inhomogeneous, but it's centered near 52 millivolts. Here's the histogram of delta. It was centered near 42, something like that. Here's the histogram of omega. It was centered, this one was a little bit higher.
This is the optimally doped material?
Yeah, this is close to optimal doping. There's a correlation between these objects and these objects, and it's negative as the gap rises, or that would be as doping falls, the energy of this putative mode falls.
What is the little bump on the high
Good question.
Omega?
Good question. It could be local modes at the dopant atoms. We can't prove that, but it could be. There is seem to be another population up there at high energies. That's omega, and that's delta. All right, so now we have been doing this for the last 2 years with Uchida Sensei's tremendous help over the range of dopants of the material. So starting at low doping, near 12%. Now we've got to pretty high doping, so my color scale is a little bit different than you've seen it in the past, because the minimum delta we're dealing with now is near 10 millivolts at whole doping over near 23%, something like that. So these look a little bit different than what I was showing you yesterday, but we have to span a wider scale. This is near optimal doping. And this is well overdoped now. It's also inhomogeneous. These are all 400 angstrom squares. It's inhomogeneous, but the magnitude of the inhomogeneity is diminishing at higher dope. Okay, now if I image this boson energy, d2idv squared peak minus delta as a function of location for these same three data sets, there are many regions here where there are no coherence peaks, and then there's no Elie-Ashberg signal. And that is not a big surprise. There's just nothing to be seen. That's what the black represents. No delta, no omega. Elsewhere, you'll see that the colors are not dramatically different. They're blue-green. And that's because the mean value of delta is actually not changing as a function of delta.
Sorry. No delta, this means you don't see omega, just because there is no feature in the original density of states that can be repeated at delta plus omega.
So that's a hypothesis, of course, but here's the empirical fact. Those black regions have this spectrum, okay? You can look at the derivative. There is a derivative, non-zero derivative, but it has no peak, so there's no energy you can locate. But you can also see there was no coherence peak in the original spectrum. All right, so here now are five different dopings. This is the histogram of the number of observations of delta in this sample. This is overdoped. And then we start to go down in doping, and the mean value of delta starts to rise, just as everyone knows. The mean value is going from 20 to about 50 millivolts as the doping goes down near 12%. In these exact same data sets, the histograms of omega are all indistinguishable from each other. So although the electronic structure was changing dramatically as the whole doping is more than doubled, the value at which the kink in D2i dv squared occurs is completely unperturbed within our reason.
I thought you just showed some data which had omega versus delta.
They can be correlated. That doesn't impact the histogram.
So then what was that, the average of this histogram? That omega that you showed?
It was a local property of a real space image. Yeah, I can show you how it's possible for them to be correlated and this still to be correct. Okay. Now this slide is here to remind me to say to you that there's a couple of reasons to believe why Eli Ashberg might be correct. One, you're getting a signature, a peak in D2i dv squared above delta. Two, when the coherence peak disappears, that signature disappears. And three, you might wonder whether the if you took these data, you say, let's suppose this feature is something else. Let's say bilayer splitting. But how could it possibly be that the value of energy from here to there is the same as a function of a wide range of doping if it was due to some standard part of the electronic structure? So that's not a definitive argument, but it's pointing in the direction that it's not just some evolution of the electronic structure, that there's a boson. Now that's our hypothesis. Okay. Now we have this d2i dv squared as a function of position and energy. And as many of you know, we've been working on the Fourier transform elastic tunneling spectroscopy for a number of years. So just do the obvious thing, take the Fourier transform of the inelastic signal. So the Fourier transform of the inelastic signal at low energy is the derivative of the quasi-particle interference signal, just as you should expect. Makes sense. But when you go up to high energies, well above delta, there's very little there, just a blob. You don't see any. Just disorder. Now you might remember though that the boson energy scale is the energy of this peak minus delta. And that's a big problem because delta is disordered as a function of location. The boson energy is completely scrambled by the disorder in delta. So what we would like to do is to construct a new, and this is a derived function. It's the second derivative as a function of location, but now as a function of an energy variable, which is the original energy variable minus the local value of delta. It's in an attempt to remove the disorder of the superconductivity from the boson information.
But that's assuming the boson is local, right? If the boson was extended, then you would have to average some.
Quite correct. And I'll show you the degree to which they are localized. So one can do that. It's a well-defined thing to do. And when we do it, that's what a very typical image looks like. So this is after the disorder in delta is removed. And its Fourier transform has a very well-defined structure, which we have repeated now many times. This Fourier transform has weak modulations in it. And you can see them here if you're used to looking at these things, or if you take off your glasses, you'll see them. There are modulations, their correlation lengths are short, and their typical period is about 5 unit cells. But this is modulations in the intensity of the inelastic signal. Now, as a function of energy, so this is lower energy to higher energy, this same signature is there, essentially independent of energy. So if this was a band structure elastic thing, you would say non-dispersive. I'm not sure what the word is for in the case of inelastic, but it doesn't change with energy. Now, because of that, we can add them all together to enhance the contrast and see quite clearly that there is a structure here, not changing with energy, and we can measure what its wavelength is. And we can do that as a function of doping. These are the mean value of delta in a sequence of samples. And these modulations in the inelastic amplitude, they're pretty broad, and they're near 5 unit cells, but they don't move around as a function of doping. So neither the mean value of the energy nor this signature was changed by Doug. Now Doug Scalapino faxed us a message saying, if you look at your quasi-particle interference signal and take the derivative, it can indeed produce a signal out here, and mathematically that's correct. And the best thing we can do to compare the elastic and inelastic signals is to plot the dispersion of this mode, which is the only one near here, and this object. And this is the dispersion of the elastic signal. The inelastic response is essentially independent of boson energy. They're certainly not somehow copies of each other. They seem to be different phenomena. Okay. That's not bad. So now I want to talk about tau 1 disorder. All the electronic disorder in the system, I talked some about it yesterday. One of the proposals is, in this recent preprint, that the disorder is not conventional, that it's somehow modulating the pair interaction on the atomic scale. The details of this model are here. That's conventional band structure. Here's the pairing interaction. Here's some potential. The impurity potential is somehow screened. The pairing interaction is disordered in space in this model, and then one solves to see what happens. There's very good agreement, statistical agreement, between the variations of the spectra as a function of location between theory and experiment for these tau 1 pairing potential scatterers. There's very good agreement between the correlations of where the dopant atoms are and what happens to the electronic structure. And there's good agreement for the properties of the spectra, the peak height versus the gap magnitude. This is the theory, this is the experiment. So, and in fact, of all the various schemes attempted to explain this disorder, at least empirically, this proposal has come closest to matching the phenomenology. Okay, now Fourier transform in elastic tunneling spectroscopy. After Wilson-Hall's experiment, many people realized instantly that this could be a very useful tool to study the cuprate problem. So there were a sequence of proposals for using the 2IdV squared to find out what bosonic, local bosonic modes are doing. And then after the development of Fourier transform elastic tunneling spectroscopy, Sasha and his group realized that Fourier transform inelastic tunneling spectroscopy could also be valuable. It would somehow try to find information in Q-space about the Q-space structure of the electron boson interaction. I asked Jun Xin Zhu to send me a one-page slide telling me what his calculations were, and here's what he sent me. I don't feel that I'm quite confident to go beyond that point, except to say that there are several modes being considered here. There's the famous B1G mode, which is a bending mode of the copper-oxygen bonds out of phase in the two directions. There's a breathing mode of the copper-oxygen bonds, and there's the famous spin resonance mode. Those are the bosonic fields being considered. Then the electronic structure is a fairly standard electronic structure. And then they solve in the Eliasberg channel to find out what does the boson do to the density of states for these different modes.
Spin resonance mode does depend on delta. You were telling us that omega of the mode you're showing us does not depend on the value of the delta.
That's not a resonance mode.
Okay. So what that's you see is definitely not a resonance.
Well, so we want, so Jun Xin wanted to be complete and taking the model he was working on, make the calculation for all the various bosonic fields on the table, as to the best I understand. Now, last year when they started this process, they were using tau 3 scattering, which is potential scattering. The disorder is making potential scattering in the crystal. Oh, why do you need the scattering? Because in order to get the real space modulation in the inelastic signal, the quasiparticle, which is dressed by the electron boson interaction, must scatter inelastically off the bosonic mode and then travel back on the trajectory it would otherwise have been on and interfere. So the property of the scatterer appears in the process. So here's potential scattering, and here's the predicted Fourier transform of d2idv squared at the resonance energy for the spin resonance, for the B1G mode, and for a breathing mode. And in fact, none of them bear very little resemblance to the experimental facts, and we were painfully aware of it. Then, a few months ago.
So what do they not explain?
Pardon me?
What does it not explain?
The primary experimental fact is that there are four peaks in the Fourier transform of d2idv squared at the locations quarter zero and zero a quarter, in what we call the reciprocal unit cell, whose dimensions are 2 pi 0. That make sense? All right, let's do it by picture. The primary experimental fact here, here's the reciprocal unit cell. That's the 2 pi 0 point. So this is the copper-oxygen bond direction. This is one reciprocal unit cell. So out here, 1/5 of the way, there's a peak in the intensity. And that's the dominant thing. The pi-pi point scattering is here, 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 and here. Jinho Li had been searching for a signal at that point for more than a year. There is no signal there in this channel. Okay, so this also had been relatively disappointing. We really weren't getting any information about electron-boson interactions. But the proposal that the disorder is not potential scattering, but it's pair disorder of the Nunner et al. Paper, immediately Zhang Xin took that as the disorder field. And when he did so, he got very different predictions for the pi-pi mode, for the B1G mode. This one certainly has its four most intense points in the copper-oxygen bond direction. They're near the quarter unit cell distance.
This is rotated with respect to the
difference. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So this is the, see, this is minus one, minus one. This is plus one, plus one. These are units of pi. So our reciprocal unit cell point is here. Half of it is here. Quarter of it is here. 1/5 is there.
James, yeah. I don't understand the statement at all. Because if you have potential disorder,
yeah,
it naturally generates pairing disorder. So these are not distinct statements.
So I'm
because
sure
as a potential disorder would, yeah, you know, generate pairing disorder, and it should have given that if the calculation is done right. I don't know how the calculation is done.
Well, I think here they're not really solving some form.
I'm sorry?
It's a local potential in the matrix form. It can have the diagonal part, which is just the potential. It can have a pair.
This is a theoretical examination of the different contributions.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
I mean, these are two extreme cases.
Yeah.
You typically have a Coulomb scatter, and there'll be a small tau 1 component induced by the scatter, but it doesn't dominate the Fourier patterns.
Yeah.
I think that's the point I'm making.
So maybe at the end of the day, let's suppose for the sake of argument, some one of these modes is the one we're really dealing with. Then what we'll really detect is some, perhaps, some in quadratures of those two effects, something like that. Okay.
Can I pause on the question? Thomas Weiner was asking, in your analysis, you assume that it's a local mode. And now we're doing a comparison to the mode which is a propagating boson, phonon.
Mm-hmm.
How does it fit together somehow?
Well, our analysis of our data is not at this stage necessarily linked to Zhang Xin's exploration of what phenomena he would find in this model.
Yeah, because it's a propagating phonon,
yeah,
and in your analysis.
So at the end of the day, we have to find some contact between these two situations.
So, Seamus?
Yeah.
You went from a situation where none of the candidates worked, now they all work.
Well, I would say this one is rather poor.
Oh, which one will this
get? The signature is supposed to be. Well, okay. You have this circle, which is something which is not detected. Otherwise,
I would like to point out one more limitation of these theories. They are all weak coupling theories.
Correct.
The actual superconductor is a strongly correlated superconductor. So I think it's very dangerous to compare too much, you know, between a weak coupling theory, because the characteristics are completely changed.
The weak coupling quasi-particle interference calculations work just fine.
That's different. That's very different. That's saying something about the stability of the
nodal
quasi-particles.
And the density of those is very small.
Yeah.
The density
of the nodal quasi-particles.
No, the quasi-particle interference scheme works right out to within 15 degrees of the zone phase.
It's not just the nodes.
It's not just the nodes.
Well, the optimal dose is not just the nodal.
But then I'm saying, the regions where you're saying delta, you know, whatever is large or small, this can change completely when you put in strong correlations. So you cannot compare, you know, okay, we can take something away from these, but to make detailed comparisons like, okay, this is rotated at 45 degrees and these will remain robust after putting in correlations, I think that's premature.
Well, it'll be interesting to find out. I agree.
Could you tell us one more time which one of these three results, what theory?
So this is
lower.
So this is tau 1 scattering.
Right.
This is tau 3 scattering.
Right, right. That's written. But which boson is with
this one? This one is B1G. Sorry, this is a matrix representation of the curve. Okay. Well, despite Nandini's cautions, these look more like the Dani to me. That's my job. Okay.
I'm sorry, can I ask a question about theory? So in that, because Bozhan Shin and Sasha know very well about filters and how the angular pattern might be changing. So was it included in this calculation?
No,
so this is just a straight density?
Straight
density.
Up, yeah.
Okay.
But there's no angular filter in the quasi-particle interference theories either, and they work fine.
Mm-hmm.
But
could you remind us, what is the doping dependence of these phonons?
You mean
running mode and the B1G?
Oh, you mean the theoretical doping dependence?
No, the experimental.
Okay.
The energies of these guys change with doping, or are they constant, like what you seem to
Well, your question is predicated on an assumption that I know what the boson is, but I don't. So the empirical facts are that the distribution of boson energies have this form, and they're independent of doping.
No, the pi pi mode changes.
Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. The pi pi mode is supposed to track Tc, so it rises up and goes back down again in energy.
What are the phonon modes? B1G and
breathing.
It doesn't really depend on
they
don't, that's the criticism.
The
mode has no.
So some of them, so Uchida sensei will comment on that question. Okay.
See that there were two modes. One is breathing, and the second is backing. Backing around the TX is plane. So that for the breathing in plane state, on the spacing time, has a little bit dependent on kappa oxygen bond length. The kappa oxygen bond length is just dependent on the doping. But anyhow, the doping range is so narrow. So that the dependent kappa oxygen bond length on doping is very small. So that in any case, both phonons weakly dependent on doping concentration. That in particular the case is backing mode. Backing mode is a CX. So that it almost independent of the doping concentration.
Okay, so here we are. We have these images. They certainly have contrast in them for bosonic energy centered around 52 millivolts, but it's inhomogeneous in this range. They have a non-dispersive structure, meaning that in that energy range, the Q of the modulation of the inelastic signal is fixed. Spatially, here's the modulations, here's their Fourier transform. As a function of doping, the distribution is unchanged, and the Q to the degree, the Q vector to the degree that we can detect it is also unchanged. So, implied in many questions have been, does this, if this is an Eliashberg signal, could it be consistent with the spin 1 pi pi resonance? And the apparent answer is no. If this is an Eliashberg signal, could it be consistent with some low energy phonon mode? The answer, we don't know which mode it is, but the answer could be yes. It's not impossible.
Sorry, low frequency?
55 millivolts.
That's fairly high energy.
Yeah, but the simple stretching mode is up near 70 millivolts, whereas the bending one may be down near 55 millivolts.
Can I flip the question around? The
pi
pi mode is there experimentally. Right.
Would you qualify that?
Well, in some materials, people say that if I go to low temperature, I will see the mode, fairly sharp resonance mode, and neutron scattering.
Oh, sure.
Right?
And it also tracks TC.
And it tracks TC.
So the question is then, why do you not see that mode when you do this measure?
Because the dominant coupling of the electronic structure to the bosonic field in the Eliashberg channel is not that mode.
do you think this mode is, I mean, this is a bad question, but anyway, do you think this mode is in any way important for the high DC?
Oh, that's a great question. So I had prepared my defense in advance. Since we need these three elements in order to make progress, and we're just beginning to work on this element right now, I don't really know the answer. But within this set of data, there's no implication that that mode is associated with the mechanism. Could be, maybe not. It does appear to be the strongest electron boson coupling that you can detect by tunneling.
At low temperatures,
after the onset in the superconducting state. Quite correct.
But it doesn't seem to change with X.
With what?
With the doping.
Correct.
So it's definitely there, you know, like, but it doesn't look like it's doing anything related to the superconducting subsystem. You know, otherwise it should have been tracking X, the doping.
But TC doesn't track X.
Oh, TC does. I mean, it changes with X.
Yeah. Oh, yes, right. Okay, so suppose you were to take the Macmillan equation at face value, let's just explore that. Then in order for a mode like this to cause TC to go up and back down again, the intensity of the G squared would have to start low, go high, and get low again. So we don't have any information on that subject.
But you don't know whether it's not causing. You know nothing to do with causing. Or you know if it doesn't feed back.
Yeah. Let's invert the question, though. There can be other states which would be stabilized by electron-phonon interactions. Let's say a charge density orbit state. Well, maybe this interaction is doing that. Yeah.
I think it's more likely to do something like that in the sense that, suppose you believe that it's the B1G, for example, and you try and take the coupling that Deborah used to explain the ARPAS data, and then you say, all right, just for fun, let's run it through and see what the TC will be within, admittedly, the hash squared, which is under attack. Or you go to low temperature where you're going to have better luck, maybe try and go after the gap. My memory is you're picking up 1-3% of what you're after. And so it's as if it has to do something else.
Yeah.
Not that it's not what you're saying, maybe it is what drives it. But it doesn't drive it within the same kind of calculation that you do here, as far as
I agree.
Anybody's calculation.
That's correct. Yeah.
How is this related to the ARPAS peak dip and calm feature?
Well, that's a good question. So the energy scales where this dip and slope appear are the same ones as the antinodal peak dip.
Yeah. And they have doping.
Well, there's an unknown averaging involved in the ARPAS experiment because you don't know how they average over the inhomogeneous environment to get the antinodal peak. So it's not so deterministic.
If I average over this, it would produce a doping independent energy.
Right. It would produce a doping?
In the end, independent mode energy.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought the ARPAS you could explain with the doping dependence of the pipeline mode plus the gap.
Well, that proposal certainly has been made.
But then they can't be the same.
But they can't be
But imagine instead of doing what you did, you subtract average gap as opposed to the local gap and see what you get in the spatial dependence of.
And it's horribly scrambled. Okay. We have done that.
So then the mode must be rather localized.
Yes, it is.
So you can promise some statement with how localized they are.
Sorry, you can tell approximately from this object here. That's about 5 or 6 or 7 unit cells.
Okay. So why does the mode have to be localized if it doesn't depend on? Oh, you're saying it depends across the sample.
Yeah, in order to subtract delta to construct an image using a boson energy scale, you do need to have some assumption about localization is the wrong word, that there is a spatial dependence of the properties of the image. Okay, well, as chairman of this session, I declare it closed.